Peter Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about...
Hopefully, this is the last episode of Wonders of the Night Sky. You Must See Before You Die by Astro Bob. And this poor library book's getting a bit of a beating. And I'll just see if I can read it through. Eta Aquilae, the heartbeat star. I sort of love these Cepheid stars. Watching a star physically change in just a week seems too much to accept, but on the contrary, the star Eta Aquilae, located just down the block from the right, the bright star Astaire in the summer triangle, brightens into plain view, fades away, and then rebrightens every 7.17 days, and it does so with the precision of a fine watch. It is bright enough to follow from the light-polluted skies and the outer suburbs, with its peak's magnitude of 3.5, about a level fainter than the Big Dipper stars. I have always made sure to glance at its direction when I'm out on a stroll in the summer and the fall nights. Doing so keeps me in touch with the simple, compelling rhythm. Once you've identified the star, it takes you only a little effort to follow its ups and downs without optical aid. When you spot the star for the first time, there's no telling where it will be on the curve, maximum, minimum, when it fades to magnitude 4.3. Somewhere in between, just watch it. A few nights and you'll get the drift soon enough. An entire circle unfolds in a week's time, making this one of the easiest variable stars to follow. If you miss it 1 week because of clouds, just drop in by the next. Eta Aquilae is a yellow-white supergiant 65 times larger than the Sun and 3,400 times more luminous, located about 1,400 light-years from your doorstep. What a shame it's not a little closer, or we would be one of the brightest suns in the sky. Eta is a Cepheid variable star named after the prototype Delta Cephei in the constellation Cephus the King. Wow! Wow! Cepheids are unstable stars and pulsate regularly. I didn't know that one. And like beating hearts, they shrink and expand in periods of range of 1 to 100 days, unlike the mirror, which is once a year. So what's going on there? Causing their temperature and brightness to vary in a very regular way. Most Cepheids rise rapidly to a maximum, followed by a slower fall to a minimum. Eta is brightest when it's expanding, like a blown-up balloon, and faintest when it's contracting, like a balloon losing air. Thankfully, the Sun doesn't seesaw back and forth like this, or its temperature on Earth would be alternate between roasting and freezing every week. Most stars visible on a clear night burn hydrogen as fuel to create energy to lead relatively stable lives, not Cepheids. After exhausting the hydrogen in the core, the Cepheids burn the next element in the chain, helium, while simultaneously burning hydrogen in the shell just outside the core. For a time, it becomes unstable and begins to pulsate. And while the pulsations have much to do with how the changing temperatures affect the helium in the star's atmosphere, we can boil it down to this. Cepheid expands, it overshoots its stable size until gravity pulls it back again. As it shrinks, the pushback pressure from the compacting gases slows and stops the collapse. When the pressure exceeds gravity's tug, the star expands and begins another pulsation star cycle. I don't know whether that's exactly the best way I like to do it. Eta Aquilae, its ups and downs were first recognised by the sharp-eyed English astronomer Edward Bigot in 1784. This is one of the brightest Cepheids known, an ideal beginning for sky watchers to get acquainted with the quick turnaround of light cycles and heartbeat stars. Oh, I sort of love that. Oh, look, there it is. I think you can see it from the southern sky. The reddest star. Wow. 52. In astronomy, seeing a red can be a good thing. Most stars look white to the naked eye because they're not bright enough to stimulate the cone cells of a retina and sense of colour. Only the brightest stars, like Antares, Betelgeuse, Spica, betray their hues. The telescope gathers much more light to the unaided eye, enough to prompt the brightness into other faint colourless stars into full colour. Anyone with a scope will be impressed by the burning purity of stellar colours that range from golden yellow to ruby red, but no green, mind you. He says no green, but he doesn't say that, but I know that. Some of the most aesthetically beautiful stars belong to the class of carbon stars. Most carbon stars are red giants. The outer envelope of the surface of the red giant looks cooler and hotter than that and hotter of the stars of some of Cirrus that glows orange or red. But carbon stars take their colour from the next level. We learned earlier that stars age and switch from burning hydrogen to helium. Burning helium creates a carbon ash. Convective currents like the ones that bubble up in pots of boiling water on the stove dredge carbon from the core and deliver it to the carbon star's outer layers. Wow. There it condenses into fine soot that absorbs the blue and the green light. Wow. Only oranges and reds penetrate the dusty barrier to reach our eyes, making carbon stars some of the reddest in the sky. So that will be a bit of a thing for the Hertzsprung-Russell diagram. One of the most striking stars is R. Lep, short for R. Leporis, constellation Lepus, the hare. Lepus crashes under Orion, the hunter, and becomes into good view in every December. To find R. Lep, start at M. Leporis, star, and hop at 3.5 degrees west, shown on the map. The star varies in brightness of magnitude 5.5, bright enough to see dimly with the naked eye, down to a faint 11.7. Most of the time it's between 6 and 10, within easy reach of a 76mm telescope. All carbon stars are variable stars and vary in brightness with periods ranging from a couple of months to more than a year. Their colour also depends on other subjective factors, including how bright the star is at the time. The brighter, the more washed out the colour. Who's doing the looking? See, you see colours a bit differently than I do. The Purkinje effect. The last depends on how long you stare at the sky. If you happen to catch R at the fainter end of the cycle, it will appear less colourful at a glance than if you stare at it continuously. Oh, that's the Purkinje effect. R. Lep is also known as Hind's crimson star after the discoverer J. R. Hind, in the 19th century English astronomer, who stumbled on the stellar ruby in 1845. Many observers describe how the colour of the transit of Mercury, isn't that beautiful? Okay. Describe its colour as intense, smoky red, and compare it to a drop of blood. But it's always reminds me of the shiny reflection from a red Christmas tree bauble association that springs to the star returns to evening sky during the winter holiday season. R. Lep's light varies over 432 days, and if you catch it near the bottom of the cycle between magnitude 10 and 8 and 10, it will look more intensely red than bright at any bright end. The natural perfume of the flower, like the intense sweetness of a white clover blossom, captivates your nose the same way the sight of a deeply reddened eyelid makes you hard to look away. Isn't that beautiful? The transit of Mercury. Now, isn't that beautiful? About 13 or 14 times a century, the planet Mercury passes directly in front of the Sun, exactly the same the Moon does solar eclipse. Because the Moon is much closer, it completely covers the Sun. Mercury, in contrast, with a diameter of just 4,579 miles, faces an impossible task. Although a bit bigger than the Moon, it's 77 million kilometres from Earth and covers only a tiny bit of the Sun. Instead of eclipse, we see a transit. I saw my first transit in 1970 after totting my telescope through the woods to the edge of the field in North Wisconsin, where the Sun stood with its clear. I remember the sight, that perfectly round black dot creeping across the Sun's face. I haven't missed a transit since 1973, 99, 2006, 2016. Three involved adventure, whether it was dropping into unannounced at an amateur astronomy observatory in a small town in Austria, or out racing clouds to find clear skies in 1999-2006. In 2016, for once, neither last-minute travel nor cloud anxiety played a part. I simply got up, drove to our local planetarium and shared the site with amateurs and passerbys under sunny skies. Isn't that beautiful? Oh, I love that. I love the transits. Transits really, I just love them, love it. Oh, I think. Adventures are common in the astronomy hobby. When you're not fighting clouds, the clock, or needing to travel, you look a bit dumbfounded. How can it be that easy? Mercury's orbit is tilted at 7 degrees to the plane of Earth's orbit, more than twice as much as any other planet. So the only time we get to see it cross the sun's face is when it happens to be in the exact same direction as the sun. At the same time, the intersects the Earth's orbital plane. This happens about 7 times a century. Because some of those transits happen when the sun's up on the other side of the world, and most of us will only see a few at a time. Well, it's 50%. Transits vary in length depending on how centrally Mercury passes the sun. Most last several hours, so there's a good chance to see at least part of one through a break in the clouds. But sometimes the planet barely grazes the sun's edges or crosses only a short distance inside the solar limb. In November 15th, 1999, the transit finished up in just 52 minutes. When the planet crosses near the centre of the solar disk, it also happens to be the closest to the sun, therefore farthest from the Earth, and appears to move more slowly. The 1970 event lasted nearly eight hours. So why stare at the black dot? First, we get a sense of the sun's enormous size. You can appreciate this. You can't appreciate this any other way except during the transit. Then it's possible to approximate and compare the Earth's girth with that of the Sun. Mercury looks like a tiny indeed. Granted, it is the smallest planet, but if the Earth were put in the same place, it still would only be 2.6 times larger. Transits also provide the opportunity to visualize the planet's location in three dimensions. Mercury's average distance from the Sun is 60 million miles. And we're 150. There you go. So when you see the dot, picture it hovering on the ground from your nose. Watching the transit is also the most popular method of detecting exoplanets, the name given to the planet that orbits other stars. As of this writing, there's nearly 4,000 have been found using the transit method. When the planet transits the stars, it temporarily dims yet only by a small, measurable amount. Repeated dips in one star's light can tell us a lot about the planet, including its size. Scientifically, astronomers use transits, Mercury transit, to measure changes, if any, in the diameter of the Sun, comparing drops in the light level between the solar and stellar transit, and to investigate the black drop effect. The black drop effect occurs at moments after the planet contacts the Sun's inner edge. Contact 2, see next page. And again, at the inner edge of the Sun, opposite side, contact 3. Both times, the planet's disk looks slightly stretched out, as if it can't quite let go of the Sun's inner edge on a way of its reaching to touch the other way out. Several factors, including diffraction, atmospheric turbulence, and less than perfect telescope optics, are the cause. Only Mercury and Venus have transits because they orbit between the Earth and the Sun. All the other planets lie beyond the Earth's orbit. When they pass near the Sun in the sky, they are on its opposite or far side. Venus's transit are even more amazing than Mercury's because the planet is 2.6 times larger and considerably closer to Earth. With the proper solar filter, Venus is plainly visible to the naked eye and striking a black disk. Venus transit occurs in pairs 8 years apart, separated by long gaps of 121.5 years and 105.5 years. The last pair occurred in June 2004 and 2012. I'd be jumping up and down now seeing the next one. If it were not for the fact that it won't happen until December 2117 and December 2008, 2125. Be sure to tell your grandkids to watch the Orion's Belt. Thank goodness for asterism. Without them, finding constellation, so asterisms, sort of the popular name for your invented backyard name for there's a sausage, there's a kangaroo, there's a whatever it is. And asteroids can either be a bright part of a constellation or parts of two different constellations connected together to form a distinctive familiar pattern. Orion's belt is comprised of three equally bright stars in a row. The best known of them, next bit, this is the Big Dipper, of course. Yeah, I can't see the Big Dipper. Let's take a minute to explore the belt. A trio of stars makes the first appearance in the evening sky in mid-October when it rises east of midnight. A month later, the daylight saving time out of the way, it's up at 9 p.m. At Christmas, it commands the southern sky. Besides the pretty symmetry and compactness, the belt of stars stands out because they're all relatively bright, each shining in around a second magnitude. Less well known are their names. Olnica and the belt of these stars, Mintaka on the west, both mean belt in Arabic. And the centre star, Olnam, represents string of pearls. String of pearls is also the Arabic name for the entire belt. All three massive stars, 90,375,000 times more luminous than the Sun. Like the constellations, many asterisms are happenstance alignments of the stars wildly different distances. While the belt stars aren't related, they lie moderately far from Earth at the same nook of the galaxy, 800 light years from for Alnac, 1,340 light years for Alham, and 195 light years for Minnetaka. The belt goes by many names from the current times across human history. Three kings, three sisters, three Marys, after the Marys in the Bible, Jacob's rod, Peter's staff, Margie, yardstick. Whatever you choose to see, Orion belt's the key, is the key to the city. With it, you can connect the rest of the dots from around to make the outline of the constellation Orion the Hunter. One should first look one fist above the button by the red supergiant Betelgeuse in the hunter's right shoulder, then over to Bellatrix, the left arm, and down to the shimmering Rigel on the foot over Cepheid, which marks his left knee. Together, the four stars form a big box around the belt. If your skies allow, don't stop there. His sword dangles below his belt. White curls of fainter stars, Arc of Betelgeuse and Betelrix, outline the club of the lion's pelt, which depicted as a shield. Above Betelgeuse and Betelrix line looks a small triangle that looks like the form of a puny head. It's always cute. It's also upside down. Yeah, knobs. You really haven't understood that, have you? Asterisms are everywhere. The Big Dipper will guide you to Ursula Major, the Big Bear, the Summer Triangle, and constellation of Cygnus, Aquila, Lyra. There's even telescopic asterisms, some of imaginative names like the Golf Putter, Napoleon's Hat, Sunken Cruton. If naked eye asterisms help to identify constellations, telescopic ones are useful for tracking down star clusters and nebula in the nearby deep star objects. They're shorthand ways to observe, to move the pattern from pattern to pattern until the target is reached. We're all born experts at seeing, creating patterns out of random information. If you've ever imagined the face of an animal amongst the turrets and folds of a puffy summer dry day cloud, you're up to asterism making your own and learn nightscapes. Let's see. Oh, gee, you've got some really cassipia. You've got your different things. You've got something called you in the northern sky. I've got the three leaps of the gazelle. Wow. I don't know why he said that. He's put his own asterisms. Oh, gee. It's number 55 here. You're seeing it going through. Surely he can't keep on going. The Big Dipper is more than what it seems. The familiar pattern isn't just a chance alignment of stars like so many other asterisms and constellations, but rather the core of the nearest star cluster named Ursula Major Moving Cluster. The Hades Cluster in Taurus, the one shaped like the letter V and hosts the bright red-orange stars Aldebaran, is the closest star cluster. You'll find it about a fist to the left of the Pleiades, the Seven Sisters. I love the Pleiades, Seven Sisters. In the late fall winter sky, Hades, the Hyades, 151 light years away, contained several hundred stars. Ursula Major Moving Cluster, UMMMC, is a much looser, sparser group of only 13 or 14 stars, almost half as close, or about 78 light years from Earth. It is barely a cluster. The reason, you'll see it sometimes described as a group, but all the stars are related as they came, as they are in more familiar clusters. They're born together as siblings in a great cloud of glass and dust just roughly 500 million years ago, and now occupy a volume of space some 30 light years long by 18 light years wide. Wow, so they're just like a pop. They're just really interesting. If you glance at the Big Dipper, you'll see it's the core of the brightest members. All but two of the Dipper's stars belong. Aklit at the end of the handle, Danube at the topmost of the star in the bowl, are unrelated to the cluster and only appear in the same line of the sight. Several fainter stars in Ursula Major and one star in the neighbourhood constellation Cairns Vindiki, its hunting dogs, comprise the cluster. There are also 42 additional stars broadly scattered across the sky from Celtus the sea monster to Lupus the wolf that belong to the largest stream of stars related and possibly to members of the clusters. How do you know stars of the UMMC are related? In 1869, English astronomer Richard Proctor discovered that they were all moving together through space, drifting slowly in the direction of the constellation Sagittarius at the rate of one full moon diameter every 16,000 years. Finding stars sharing the same motion and age is typically how astronomers identify stars related from random ones. Our solar system is located on the outskirts of the cluster, but its much greater age makes it unrelated. Meanwhile, we plant tomatoes and shovel snow. This sparse collection of suns is moving in the direction at 7 miles per second, 11.5 kilometres a second. That's about, in about a million years, it will pass us at a distance of only 51 light years. So it's, I don't know how far away it is, it's 150, so it's really coming towards us. You might wonder if the sun will ever be part of the cluster. It may well have been, but most star clusters, like Hades at UMMC, have relatively short lifetimes of a few hundred billion years. That may sound particularly forever, but it's not in relation to typical stars like the sun, which will live more than 10 billion years old before running out of fuel. So star clusters come, it's amazing, that's what star clusters sort of burst into light and go. So that's amazing. That's star clusters, as they all are sort of super active and producing huge stars which operate really quickly. Unlike the beehive-like balls of globular clusters, stars in Hydrus-type cluster are open clusters, are only loosely bound by the mutual gravities. A star's individual motion can cause it to break away and leave its siblings behind. Star clusters are also subject to bigger forces intent on ripping them apart. As clusters revolve about the galactic centre, massive clouds of dust and gas, as well as tides, produce a shear in the mass of stars. The Milky Way will take it apart star by star. Still, with the right tools, we might try to identify which far-flung star may once have been the sun's brothers and sisters. Stars born together share similarities in the atmospheric chemistry, the motion since throughout space. Astronomers have studied the number of these nearby stars and identified at least one good candidate, a star slightly more massive than the sun, HD 1628-26, 110 light years away from the constellation Hercules, that may have much They may once have been pals, our sun. There are some sights in the night sky that may not appear compelling at first blush, but once you know what you're seeing, they help you appreciate them on some deeper level. Something as familiar as the Dipper can take us on a journey across many light and clock years, forming us into a grand movement of the twinkle overhead. So that's beautiful. Now, here's how we're going for time here. So it's only 24 minutes and we're up to 56. Oh, it's just... anyone with the top 10 lunar wonders... there you go. Anyone with a pair of binoculars or, better, a small telescope, or there are provisions of craters, mountains, peaks and ranges, lava flows, cliffs. Because the moon is so close, you can see the details smaller than 1.6 kilometres across with a small telescope. After working the planets hard for a glimpse of cloud, a feature of vague dark markings, the moon gives us so much effort, just point and look. And if the seeing conditions are reasonably tranquil, you'll get transfixed. Besides Mars, the moon is the only body in the solar system with a surface we can see clearly. The Apollo leftovers, including flags, rovers, descent modules, are well beyond the capability of even the Hubble Space Telescope. But at least we can see where they landed. When the first time scope users get to look at the moon, I hear at least as many wows as they see at Saturn. How to boil down hundreds of sights and a few must-sees. In choosing these, I must face the criticism from some long-term moon watchers for leaving out their favourite, but I guarantee to get you off to a good start. You really know the moon goes through phases. The new moon evening crescent half, called first quarter phase, waxing gibbous, full waning gibbous, last third quarter, morning crescent, and back anew. When the moon waxes from evening crescent to full, an advancing line of sunrise to the moon called the terminator moves from the east, exposing a new slice of the moon's surface each night. After full phase, the terminator defines the advancing run of the sunset. Each night, more and more, the moon becomes covered with shadow and removed from view. If you were a lunar astronaut standing somewhere along the terminator, you'd see the sun at sunrise and sunset very low on the horizon. As on Earth, the low sun casts long shadows. Shadows reveal lots of detail on the moon's surface, the same way as shadow light clearly exposes the lines and textures of a person's face. Every hill, crater, wall and cliff of the moon throws a shadow when the terminator is nearby, making it the best place to see lunar features under the most dramatic lighting. I've listed and described 10 of the finest sights on the next page, along with a number of days after the new or full moon when to look most spectacular. We'll be following and advancing the terminator as we move from one highlight to the next. Isn't that lovely the way they do it? Use this mini moon guide to help you find the top 10 lunar things. Theo Trio. Theophilus, he's the friend of Plato. Cirrus and Catrina, the eye-catching trio of large craters, each about 60 miles across and around 2 miles deep. You can easily see that Theophilus, with one of the most obvious central mountain peak, and is the youngest because it looks crisper and overlies the older eroded crater of Cirrus. I don't know where they're cratered. So you've got Plato, Copernicus, all this Tycho, Highlands, Theo Trio. There's the Theo Trio. Oh, wow. I can see the Theo Trio. What a beautiful theme. And so there's Theophilus. Aridaeus Rill, a long, narrow crack resembling a valley. Some rills were once conduits for molten lava, but this one formed when a section of the moon crust between two faults sunk to create a segmented valley 233 kilometres long. It's located between the southern highlands and the Apennine Mountains. Southern highlands, Cranomania, feast your eyes on this region of ancient lunar crust that still bears the scars of thousands of overlapping impact craters of all sizes. You can guesstimate their relative ages by comparing those with have sharper rinds to others that have softer, more eroded... I don't know what the softer, more eroded things. I don't know how that... The Apennine Mountains are a rugged arc of mountains that with peaks reaching to altitudes of 2 to 5 kilometres, named after the Apennines in Italy. The range is relatively young at 3.9 billion years compared to 4.4 billion years old highlands. Unlike Earth's mountain ranges, which form through movements of crustal plates, the lunar Apennines formed in the aftermath of a huge asteroid impact that excavated the neighbouring sea of showers, Mare Irrigium Basin. The curving shape of the mountains form part of the rim of the basin. Copernicus Crater, one of the most magnificent lunar craters, especially when observed straddling the terminator in the interior, filled with the brim with its inky black shadow. 58 miles, 93 kilometres across, and 3.8 kilometres deep, Copernicus displays several small central peaks, terraced interior walls caused by slumping, and at full moon, a corona of bright rays. These thousands of secondary impact excavating fresh material from beneath the lunar topsoil. These rays are best visible in a full moon. This is the white strikes. Plato Crater, 109 kilometres across. Plato's relatively smooth, dark floor makes it look like an oval swimming pool. The funny description contains a grain of truth. Plato's interior was flooded with lava sometime after 3.8 billion years ago, with a depth of just 1 kilometre. It's shallow compared to many other craters. Tycho Crater. When near the terminator, this 86-wide diameter crater looks crisp, fresh and deep. Its floor is 4.8 kilometres deep, below the average surface level, and boasts a pointy peak. One of the youngest, the largest lunar crater, the asteroid that blasted Tycho struck the moon only 108 million years ago, an event the dinosaurs may have noticed around, so, oh, around 'The full moon, when light shines straight down the crater, it transforms into a brilliant white spot surrounded by extensive aura of brilliant rays. Straight Wall, a nearly linear fault, 110 kilometres long and about 2 kilometres wide, although only 300 metres when viewed near the waxing moon temp, the wall casts a prominent shadow that makes it look quite deep. After a full moon, it looks like a thin, bright line. Ah, so you want to get the terminator. It's good to talk about the terminator. Here we go. Cygnus Iridium, Latin for Bay of Rainbows, is 236-mile wildlife plain in one of the moon's most beautiful features. Two rocket promontories are arms out to frame a bay that in low sunlight appears filled with long ocean-like rollers. The waves along the ridges that form when the basaltic lava is cooled and contracted after flooding the area. In fact, Cygnus Iridium is really what's left after a large impact crater, with half its outline submerged beneath the ancient lava flows. Aristus Crater, only 40 kilometres wide, this crater stands out better than any twice its size because it's one of the brightest spots on the moon. It doesn't hurt that it also sits on a vast dark lava plain called Ocean of Storms, making it at strong contrast. Around full moon, it looks like a searchlight in the dark, bright rays made even more prominent. Aristus and Copernicus are visible without optical aids in a bright, diffuse spots on a full moon. Surely, I'm running out of steam here. See how many more I've got to do. 57? Oh. Oh, this is the last one. 57. Collect Duo M18 and Messner 82. Now, I think Messner, what is Andromeda? I think Messner 31, I'm not sure. We've knocked around the Milky Way, stuck our nose in Magellan clouds, took a trip to Andromeda galaxy. What's beyond? Only 2 trillion more galaxies. That's the most recent estimate on how many other Milky Ways populate the universe. To grasp the magnitude of this number, we took We look to time. 1 million seconds equals 11.5 days. 1 billion seconds equals 31.57 years. 1 trillion seconds equals 13,000 years. 2 trillion seconds equals 61,000 years. Tick, 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 tick. 1 second each galaxy. Oh, wow. We can use binoculars to leap beyond Andromeda to a pair. Isn't that a beautiful way of doing it? A pair of galaxies not far from the bowl of the nicknamed Spode Galaxy, Cigar Galaxy. Both were catalogued by Messner as M81 and 82, but discovered by the German astronomer Johann Bode in December 31, 1774. They're bright and easy to see as galaxies go, with magnitudes 6.9 and 8.4 respectively, and they're favourite targets for beginning amateur astronomers in the Northern Hemisphere, mind you. Through 7x35 binoculars and dark skies, they're dim side-by-side smudges, but a pair of larger 10x50s, you can see much more. After a pleasant star hop from the bowl in the general direction of the North Star, look to the two grey patches of fuzz. They're close together, and if you do find the brighter one, MAT81, it will take you directly to the faintest star, puffing away just 5 degrees to its north. Both are easy to see the northern sky most of the year, but highest when the Big Dipper is nearly overhead each spring. Because looking straight up is hard on the neck, the view is more comfortable in summer when you find them conveniently placed in the northwestern sky at nightfall. Their apparent closeness isn't a line of sight ruse. Both are 12 million light years away, or almost 5 times further than Andromeda, and physically close together in space, separated by just 150,000 light years. You might even say they're in a relationship. Gravity has stripped the gas from the other. M82, that material has fallen into the galaxy centre, becoming compressed into small, vigorous, new round star formation. None of this tumult is directly visible in binoculars or modest amateur telescopes, but we won't let it stop us. What you can't see in binoculars of M81's oval shape and the brightest centre, where the stars are concentrated in greater numbers. The smaller, fainter star lies due north of M81. If your eyes are fully dark adapted and you avert your vision, its tilt is discernible. Back again, reading about these last two galaxies here, and it's interesting that one's eating another, you know, sort of some action happening. Smaller, fainter cigar lies due north of M81. Your eyes are fully dark adapted and you'll avert your vision. This is true in army patrolling, in terms of that you had to patrol looking to the side of your eyes. Take this scene in and try to appreciate it within the twin fuzziness represents the combined light of 10 billion suns, which is nothing. We're 100 billion. We're 2 trillion. I think we're 200 billion. I can't remember. The light of which left the galaxies when the Earth had no human footprints. In fact, we can see Sis Exotica from our own homes, reminds us the universe is never far away. Starlight shines in our houses and apartments. The moon rises, tides, galaxies remind us of how far space goes. And it goes and goes and goes, not far from M81 and 82, just above the back end of the Dipper's bowl lies an unremarkable patch of sky with no obvious stars or galaxies. Here, astronomers Bob Williams of the Space Telescope Science Institute used the Space Telescope to take 342 separate exposures over 10 consecutive days between December 18 and 28 in 1985. Basically, the Hubble stared at nothing for more than 100 hours, but with this shard of sky measuring less than the 10th diameter of a full moon, his images revealed a rich assortment of more than 3,000 spiral elliptical irregular galaxies, some of which date back 12 billion years, not long after the origin of the universe, the Big Bang. Many are small, irregularly shaped and glow blue with new stars, teething babies that would much later merge with other small galaxies to build many of the big galaxies we see around us today. Because light takes billions of years to reach our eyes with these little ones, we see them as they were billions of years ago. William's use of the valuable time of the Hubble Space Telescope to see into space was scoffed at by some astronomers, but the gamble revealed that beyond the empty space between the stars lies billions of galaxies undreamt of only decades ago. It also provides crucial evidence showing how a myriad of small galaxies from the early days of the universe merged to our big ones. Mergers continue today, with some surprisingly close to come. The Milky Way's two large satellite galaxies, Magellanic Clouds, appear to be in collision course with the home galaxy sometime in the far future. But it's only a warm-up for the big smash-up of the Andromeda. He's already covered this. Andromeda galaxy screening towards the Milky Way. And that's how to see it. Now, we're here, we'll do the epilogue for him, because he's such a brilliant writer, it'll probably be a brilliant epilogue. Like many of you, I'm the owner of a furry Canis Major. Her name is Sammy. We always thought she was mostly border collie, but my daughter gifted me a doggy DNA kit a few years back, and now we know scientific certainty she's German, because of German Shepherd, Siberian Husky, Golden Retriever. She's a mutt. Sammy is going to be 18 years old now, that's in human years, and has neither the spunk nor bladder control of a young pup. She wanders, places get confused. In her aging, I see what's in store for all of us as we pass from one stage of life to the next. Intentionally or not, we humans often leave a legacy before we depart. Maybe a big building, a work of art, or an exemplary life. As I stare down at my panting dog, it occurs to me that she's leaving a legacy too, one she's completely unaware of, but it's much I'll always appreciate. Thanks to my dog, I've seen more auroras and lunar halos than I can count. That goes for meteors, contrails, space station passes, light pillars, moon rises too. All of this because she needs to be walked in the early morning again at night. This simple act ensures that while Sammy sniffs and marks, I can spend at least 20 minutes under the sky almost every night of the year. I'm an amateur astronomer and keep tabs on what's up, but my dog makes sure I don't miss a beat. She says, let's say she keeps me honest, but there's no avoiding going out, or I'll pay for it with whimpering and cleanup. There have been times I was totally unaware of the aurora was underway until Sammy needed to be walked. When we were done, I'd often dash away to the dark sky with a camera and a tripod to record the share of lights. Other nights, walking the dog would alert me to a sudden clearing and an opportunity to catch a valuable star rise or see a newly discovered comet for the first time. Amateur astronomers routinely brush up against eternity. We observe stars and galaxies by our telescope that remind us both of the vastness of space and the aching expanses of time. I've only so many years left before I spend the next 10 million disassembled and strewn about like a scarecrow attacked by flying monkeys. But when I see Andromeda Galaxy through my telescope with the 25 billion-year-old photons setting off a tiny explosion in my retina, I get a taste of eternity in the here and now. That's where Sammy offers yet another pearl. Dogs seem to be far better job of living in the moment than people. They can eat the same food twice a day for a decade and relish it new every single time. The same goes for the excitement of seeing the owner and taking a walk, or millions of other ways they reveal that this is the moment that counts. People tend to think of eternity as encompassing all time, but Sammy has a different take. A moment fully experienced feels like it might never end. Lose yourself in the moment and the clock stops ticking. I love that feeling. That's how our dog has been living all its canine all along. Canine wisdom, 1 billion years equals one moment. Both feel like forever. Sammy's lost much of her hearing and some of her eyesight. We're not sure how much time she has, maybe a few months, maybe even another year, but her legacy is clear. She's been a great pet and a teacher. Even if she's figured out how much, she's never figured out how to fetch. We've hiked hard trails together, and we've rested atop precipices and the sun's sinking the west. I look into her clouded eyes these days and have to speak up when I call her name, but she's been remains a good dog. Maybe you have a dog or maybe you don't, but the point is the same. The night sky lies at the junction of the infinite moment and the time eternal. Open the door, step outside, look up. Infinity awaits. So that's a beautiful way. He is such a good writer, isn't he? Okay.
Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.